Natural Living with Gary Nall, Mondays and Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. During this hour, we have the latest on health and healing. We have some insights into how the Republicans are using the budget to wage a massive assault on the environment and roll back crucial protections that have been there since Ralph Nader put them in place. Also, as many of you know, if you go to GaryNall.com, we have an awful lot of articles, fully referenced, that shows you the danger of fluoridation of the mercury in your fillings in your mouth. Many of the things we take for granted, we look at and then we challenge. So we're going to do a little commentary from Mahesh Goldstein on fluoridation, the scam of the century, since now they're finding, yeah, we were right, the mercury in your teeth doesn't stay in your teeth, in your filling, your silver filling. It comes out, and how that can adversely affect you. And then, time permitting, the 15 dirty big pharma tricks that rip you off and risk your health for profit. Martha Rosenberg, Alternet. And something they're doing in England that we're not doing in the United States. Time permitting, I'll get to that. We have a lot to share. You can also watch our program by going to GaryNall.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'm in my office in New York City, back from my travels, filming on the poor around the United States, filmed in over 20 states, and there's an awful lot of working poor. There's an awful lot of people who we should be helping, and they're not getting the help they deserve. So when that documentary comes out, I'll come down to Washington, D.C. and show it for our listeners there who I know are sensitive to these issues. Let's take a look at the latest in health and healing. First up, milkweed zap skin cancers. This is the latest in the Journal of British Dermatology, and it says, quote, if you talk about herbs, plants, and other totally natural substances having the potential to actually cure cancer, odds are you'll be greeted with eye-rolling disbelief, especially from the mainstream medical establishment. But research just published in the Journal of British Dermatology provides compelling evidence that the sap from a common weed known as milkweed or pedisurge can literally cure certain types of cancers. Although regarded as a nuisance weed by most gardeners, the plant has been valued for centuries in many folk medicine traditions as a treatment for asthma, warts, and several types of cancer. Now a group of Australian scientists from a number of medicinal institutions in Brisbane have tested milkweed sap on humans and found that it works remarkably well on non-melanoma skin cancers. And by the way, non-melanoma skin cancers, which affect hundreds of thousands of people worldwide, are rarely fatal. However, they can be disfiguring without treatment. So that's good news. So, gee whiz, 41 out of 48 cancers had completely disappeared after using the milkweed sap. Well, that's excellent. Next up, and again, I only use peer-reviewed literature. I only use research that mainstream science has discovered. Then, as one of the people who blogged me said, well, my doctor said don't trust any of the stuff said by anyone in the alternative field because there's never good science to back it up. Just the opposite. Everything that we do is based upon good science. Virtually everything. And I cite that science. I give you the peer-reviewed journal. I give you the publication. Now, here's how it works. Good science supports alternative healing and herbs and nutrients, lifestyle and stress management and exercise. But then who reads the original science? I do. First thing I get up early in the morning at 4 o'clock is I look at the world scientific literature. But then that has to get selected and deciphered. And what happens is mainstream media, more often than not, will not promote something if it seems like it could in any way challenge the pharmaceutical approach. So if there's something natural that'll prevent a cold, you won't hear about it. It's rare. So we go to the regular science and bypass medicine censorship. If you're a man, check your testosterone levels. Why? Here's the latest study from the peer-reviewed journal Heart. It says that low testosterone levels means that you're going to die over a 7-year period quicker. Quote, a report published in the journal reveals an increased risk of premature death from all causes and cardiovascular disease among men whose testosterone levels were deficient. Researchers at the Royal Holmeshire Hospital in Sheffield, England, analyzed data from 930 men with cardiovascular disease who underwent elective coronary angiography in a cardiac referral center, and they found that those with the lowest testosterone levels were the ones who died the fastest. Now, it's relatively easy to get your testosterone levels up, but first check for free testosterone. It's the free testosterone that's going to help you get your muscle mass back, your mood elevated, your strength back, endurance. All that comes from having elevated testosterone back to its normal level. High LDL levels, those are the bad cholesterol in early life, which a lot of teenagers have, predict coronary calcification. Quote, people seldom die of a sudden heart attack. Instead, coronary artery blockage represents an accumulation of risk factors that were reversible if detected before the heart attack happened. A meticulous study done recently by the Annals of Internal Medicine looked at a large group of individuals between 18 and 30. And then they found that a lot of them, very young, had elevated bad cholesterol. Saturday night, I went to a movie here in New York. It was a screening of a film on fast food and heart disease. The feature in the film was a group of individuals who had been told they had to have coronary bypass operation or stents to save their lives. All of them were overweight, had terrible diets, didn't exercise, didn't care what they ate. And now they were facing death. They selected instead to go on a program by a top surgeon at the Cleveland Clinic. And this surgeon was not, the program was not supported by the doctors in the hospital. He saw that, and he was very honest. He said, look, coronary bypass surgery and stent surgery will not prevent you from dying. It will not extend your life. All it is a Band-Aid. It's to help you in an extreme emergency from dying at that moment. But none of it's curative. None of these drugs they give you are curative. It's so rare for someone who is so well-respected in a field, who's the top of their game, to be that honest about their own skills. And then he gave examples in the film of how arteries clog. And it's not the big, massive clog that kills. It's the tiny little lesions that come from eating a diet that's high in meat and carbohydrates. Things we talk about all the time on this program. And then he put some people on a plant-based diet. And it showed the struggle they had because they were eating vegetables and fruits and beans and whole grains that normally they wouldn't have. But after a period of time, their arteries reversed their clogging, and now they were actually healthy. None required the surgery. Later, much later, the Cleveland Clinic actually allowed this man to treat patients in the Cleveland Clinic. Interesting, even though he had published a paper, and reviewed all the things about how limiting these coronary bypass, and even though they're glorified, he said it doesn't cure anybody. They finally let him treat some patients in his Cleveland Clinic, but there was an interesting piece of little medical politics in it. There was a representative of the American Heart Association on the program, and she was advocating a cholesterol level of 200, which is what the American Heart Association says your cholesterol should be. I've said my cholesterol is 115. I've said the cholesterol should be under 125. I said if you take an average, the average cholesterol in America is 207 to 209. To say cholesterol should be 200 is way above it. Well, he showed studies that one-third of all the heart attacks and blockages happen in people with cholesterol of 200. Therefore, one-third of all the people who are needing these procedures or dying each year are dying by honoring the American Heart Association's guidelines, which are all wrong, and it's all politics. It also showed there was a woman. I'd never seen her before. She was the top woman at the USDA, and she was given the task of coming up with a healthy food pyramid. And in the first interview I've seen, and I commend the producers of the film for getting this, she showed that she had the information from all the best available science showing that most of the diet should be grains and legumes and beans and fruits and vegetables. That should be the base of the pyramid. And so she sent it over to the secretary of the USDA, and it came back saying, no can do. No. So there was these discussions. And then get this. She says that she was invited by one of the top PhDs of a major East Coast university, that I know which one it is, that used the food industry for sponsorship of its health programs, that invited her to a meeting. He came to Washington because she was going to state that all that fat in the diet was dangerous and that it contributed to cancer and heart disease and oxidative stress. So she wanted those foods identified, so people then saw which foods were high in fat and bad and put them at the small end of the pyramid. So she meets him in the lobby of the hotel, and she found that unusual. That why would he want her, the head of this whole department, the USDA, to go to a hotel? And then he says, come up to my room. She says, I don't do that. I'm not going up to him. He says, no. I've got papers I've got to show you, and I'll leave the door open. I'm a married man. I don't have any problem. And so he was also an attorney. So she goes up the room. He sits on a couch. She sits on the edge of this bed, and he opens up a briefcase and says, here's $67,000 in cash for you if you agree not to mention the high fat level in these foods, because these were the foods from companies that this university and this professor received money from. And she said, it was amazing that he was bribing me. And she said no to him. And he opened up just to show her all the money. And she said that how many other people would have accepted the money? Or how many other people have been offered bribes and turned it down? Well, we know how many, like Cunningham, who went to prison because he accepted the bribes. In any case, not unusual. But I'd never seen that interview. And then she said, back came all the suggestions, and the meat industry, the dairy industry, the egg industry, the cereal industry, the sugar industry would not allow the truth to come out at the USDA. And they had so much power politically that the real food pyramid was not allowed to come out. And then get this. I didn't know this. This was brand new information. That 95% of all government subsidies, meaning you and I, the subsidies do not go for fruits and vegetables, organic farming. Less than one half of 1%, 95% goes to the meat industry, the dairy industry, a pizza company that the USDA got to use more cheese. So our government is controlled once again by special food industry. So the truth doesn't come out. So good science is usurped by official science. Just thought I'd share that with you because I saw that on Saturday night, and I was one of the panelists afterwards who was asked, about what do we do? And I said, well, first, stop eating meat. Go vegan. Stop buying from any store that offers product from China. Support American-made products. Buy locally. Don't use genetic engineered. Simple things we could do. Take your money out of a national bank and put it into a credit union account or a small savings loan. These, if enough people did them, would make an impact. They would make a difference. And so anyhow, now we see from this study, also in the film, they showed that when the surgeon said that when they would have autopsies of young teenagers who died in car wrecks, they already had major heart disease. They already had holes in their lungs. They had all kinds of problems as teenagers. Did you know that 22% of all the vets killed in the Korean War had heart disease? They were 22 years old. No, excuse me, 77% of the vets who were 22 years old when they died in the Korean War had heart disease. That is how little we have learned from our lessons. So here's this study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine that shows that when you are consuming the average American diet, you're going to have an elevated LDL. That's bad, and that's going to cause coronary calcification, and that can lead to these many heart attacks. So that's the latest on health and nutrition. But good news on gamma tocopherol, that's the vitamin E of specific type. Most of you get alpha tocopherol, get gamma tocopherol. According to the International Journal of Cancer, researcher at Australia's Queensland University of Technology have found that gamma tocopherol and tocotrienols, and that's, by the way, the tocotrienols are one of the eight forms of vitamin E, could help prevent prostate cancer regrowth due to an ability to inhibit prostate cancer stem cells. And the research was described in the current issue of the International Journal of Cancer. Dr. Patrick Ling and colleagues demonstrated that gamma tocotrienols downregulates the expression of prostate cancer stem cell markers in androgen-independent prostate cancer cell lines. So that's good news. These are inexpensive, easy to get, and you can get them in any health food store. And Lutein, L-U-T-E-O-L-I-N, can help prevent memory loss. Researchers at the University of Illinois report that the flavonoid lutein helped reduce inflammation in the brains of aged mice, which restored memory to levels observed in younger animals. So that's good news. That's inexpensive. That was published in the Journal of Nutrition. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. Back with you in a moment. Please stay with us. To welcome all of you, I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all very much for supporting the station and our recently completed fund drive. Today I'm going to be taking calls on any issue you find important. I'm at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Haven't been able to take calls because we've been in fund drive mode, but now we're not, and you have a chance to call in. 888-874-4888. And now two commentaries, one on our environment, and the other on something you didn't know about the United Kingdom and their Tea Party. They're doing something good, something we could learn from. that in a moment. From Tara Lohan, Alternet. Water is our single most critical resource, quote, yet Republicans are using the latest budget bill as a weapon to strip away basic protections that help preserve the water resources we all depend on for survival. And they're also attacking our air and food and wild lands. Here's the latest on this. This is from Tiffany Pache, writes for D.C. Bureau about the GOP's continuing resolution, H.R. 1 budget bill, quote, that would deny funding to the Environmental Protection Agency to implement guidelines needed to enforce the Clean Water Act. Well, not only is there language in the bill itself that is detrimental to environmental and human health, but legislators have tacked on over 400 amendments, some of which could roll back decades of hard work and critical environmental protections. One of the areas that will be particularly hard hit is Appalachia. That's an area I grew up in West Virginia, in a region that has already been sacrificed for our love of cheap coal. Residents of Appalachia, by the way, have been working tirelessly to end the horrific practice of mountaintop removal mining, which President Obama supports, which allow coal companies to blast away entire mountaintops, dump the debris into rivers and streams, contaminate waterways and drinking water with chemicals, and threatens the health and safety of residents in the region. Now, all the hard work that activists have done to try to end this practice is in jeopardy. From politicians, both Democrats and Republicans, who'd rather serve the coal industry than their own constituents. J.W. Randolph of Appalachia Voices writes a breakdown of some of the most dangerous amendments. Excuse me, my voice is a little stressed right now because I've been fundraising all day on our sister station in New York. Amendment 109 from Griffith, Republican from West Virginia. This amendment would defund EPA's authority to implement its recent guidance regarding mountaintop removal, which protects American citizens in Appalachian headwater streams from toxic mountaintop removal mining. Amendment 216. That's another McKinley, Republican, West Virginia. This amendment would defund EPA's ability to implement its authority under Section 404C to veto the Clean Air Act permits that represented a threat to public health and well-being. Amendment 219 and 220, a Republican from Johnson, Ohio. These amendments would defund the Department of Interior's ability to implement its stream protection rule, which is currently being drafted in order to protect it, our citizens from toxic coal waste. Now, these riders are a massive assault on the environmental movement and on the communities of Appalachia. And as Randolph writes, they have nothing to do with reducing our budget, but instead are aimed at removing citizens' protections from mountaintop removal. Unfortunately, these are not the only threats to environmental and human health in our country. Wonk Room has a more comprehensive list, and sadly, the bad amendments keep coming. I mean, I'll just give you one example. Amendment 10, Stearns, a Republican from Florida, to stop the EPA from developing or issuing standards that list coal ash as hazardous waste under the Resource Conservation Recovery Act. Well, of course, coal ash is a hazard, but these are all Republicans who are against all this. So look for our environmental protections to be taken away from us, and that's unfortunate. Now, one thing I've been warning you about for a long time is fluoridation. Not only warning you, but I've written a definitive article on fluoridation called The Fluoride Fiasco, which is posted on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and GaryNoll.com. This is from Hash Goldstein, quote, this scam starts as follows. The CDC, in their Morbidity and Mortality Weekly reports of August 17, 2001, Volume 50, RR14, entitled Recommendations for Using Fluoride to Prevent and Control Dental Caries in the United States, says on page 4, paragraph 5, quote, that fluoride's predominant effect is after the tooth comes into the mouth and on the surface of the tooth, unquote. The question posed to the CDC, the EPA, and the public health officials of why then do we have to ingest it. Never gets answered. Then there's the issue of informed consent. Every doctor knows that they can't force any medication on an individual without their informed consent. The doctor has to tell the patient of the benefits and of any side effects of a prescribed medication. This puts the final decision to take or not take the medication in the hands of the patient. In addition, the patient has the right to question any treatment so as to make a better decision. Fluoridation clearly violates this principle. And one of the arguments presented by those who push this is to say that no one is forced to drink the water. Yes, the fluoride comes to the tap, but ultimately it's the individual's choice to open the tap and drink the water. Well, that's not a serious argument. Another argument is that fluoride is not a drug, but rather it is a nutrient. So when the question of since when is the toxic waste byproduct of the phosphate fertilizer industry or the aluminum or steel industry a nutrient? They usually look at their watches and tell you they hear their mother calling when you ask them to answer that. If it indeed it is a nutrient, then why then do the CDC and the ADA, the American Dental Association, the major pushes of fluoridation in the United States, say that tooth decay is a chronic infectious disease and recommend fluoride to combat the disease? And why does the Fraud and Drug Administration call fluoride an unapproved drug? What a classic example of blatant hypocrisy. Earl Baldwin, a member of the British House of Lords and one of the advisory board members of the York Review, the UK-sponsored review of fluoridation, had this to say, quote, What physician do you know who in his or her right mind would treat someone who does not know and has never met with a substance that's meant to do changes in the body with this advice? Take as much or as little as you like, but take it for a lifetime because it may help someone's teeth. With fluoridation, there is no control over who gets the medication or the dosage. What if someone is particularly sensitive to the subject? Tough. What if you're an athlete and drink a gallon of water a day? Tough. When a person consumes a medication, say aspirin, for example, isn't the dose for an infant or a child different than that for an adult? Obviously, with fluoride, it's one-size-fits-all mentality. Let's say for a moment that the ingestion of fluoride is a good thing. Who gets more? Your body or your dishes when you wash them? Your car when you wash it? Your lawn when you water it? Or the environment when you flush the toilet? You answer that one, and then let me know if mandated fluoridation is a good thing or a bad thing. Should you raise the issue of reduced tooth decay? It has already been proven and documented those living in unfluoridated communities have virtually the same rates of tooth decay as those living in fluoridated communities. But there is one profound difference. Those living in fluoridated communities have a much, much greater risk of dental fluorosis, which is symptomatic of the discoloration and eventual mottling of the teeth, leading to a lifetime of cosmetic veneers or living with a disfiguration. As if ruining your teeth isn't enough, there has been credible documentation showing other debilitating effects. Professor Phyllis Mullenix proved that fluoride had an adverse effect on the brain. As a result, she was told that her work, quote, was no longer relevant to dentistry, unquote, and fired. Peer-reviewed studies showed adverse effects of fluoride on the thyroid gland were ignored, as were studies linking fluoride to damage the pineal gland. The pineal gland is located between the two hemispheres of the brain and is responsible for the synthesis and secretion of melatonin. Melatonin affects jet lag, sleep patterns, and aging in the immune system, and by the time of old age hits, the accumulation of fluoride in the pineal gland is in very high concentrations. But wait, there's more. There is also a profound connection between fluoride and bone damage. With symptoms almost identical to arthritis, beginning with itching, aching of the bones and joints. But the best cover-up had to come out of Harvard University. As part of Elise Bassin, as part of her 2001 doctoral thesis for her dental degree, found a connection between fluoride and bone cancer in adolescent boys. When she submitted her findings to Dr. Chester Douglas, the head of Harvard's dental school, he omitted that finding when releasing her thesis. Why would he do this? Maybe the fact that he was on the payroll, the Colgate-Palmolive company had something to do with it. Somehow, years later, Bassin's findings were found and released, causing Harvard to do a complete investigation on Dr. Douglas. During the investigation, Dr. Douglas made a $2 million donation to Harvard and was eventually exonerated. One other finding was an adverse effect on the kidneys by fluoride. It was found that fluoride can damage the kidneys at high levels and that someone with poor kidney function would have limitations clearing fluoride from the body, making that person especially vulnerable to fluoride's other toxic effects. With all this adversity, is there any group, organization, or government agency accepting any responsibility? No. One would think that if the entities heavily involved in fluoride's promotion, someone would take charge or accept liability. The American Dental Association does not, the CDC does not, the EPA does not, the FDA does not, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services does not, the National Sanitation Foundation does not, yet all these government agencies pass the buck to the National Sanitation Foundation, who in turn accepts no liability for the safe levels of or safety of the chemical it recommends. So what started out as an experimental program in 1945 without any health studies done whatsoever turned out to be a cash cow for industries that previously had to dispose of this toxic waste to the tune of millions of dollars a year. There's a book out there entitled Protecting Public Health and Environment, Implementing the Precautionary Principle. The precautionary principle means that if there is a uncertainty, yet credible scientific evidence or concern of threats of health, precautionary measures should be taken. Applying the precautionary principles to fluoridation, the following questions and answers arise. Is the risk of harm plausible? Yes. Is the evidence of harm supported by a number of peer-reviewed studies published? Yes. Is the potential harm serious? Yes. Are the effects reversible? No. Is the public being informed of the potential health risks? No. Does the proposed intervention achieve the desired benefit? No. How significant are the consequences if the practice is halted? Not very. Are there alternatives? Yes. Dr. Joel Tickner and Melissa Coffin, two scientists that examined the water fluoridation controversy in the context of the precautionary principle, raised the following questions in the issue of the Journal of Evidence-Based Dental Practice. Quote, whether there are other ways of delivering fluoride besides water, whether fluoride needs to be swallowed to prevent tooth decay. It should be noted, and other questions, it should be noted that this is all based upon a community. Plus, we're getting fluoride from foods and beverages. Despite the recommended ingestion of fluoride at 1.2 parts per million, the reality is that people are ingesting fluoride at 8 parts per million per day. So we have been had and lied to. Now, that's that person's work. I did a scholarly work on it with all the scientific references showing that fluoride is a poison. It should never be ingested. It does not prevent tooth decay. It's extremely toxic. And one of the founders of the National Cancer Institute, Dr. Dean Burke, and a leading scientist, Dr. John Yamyanis, showed in their studies that 30,000 Americans die every year from the consequences of fluoride ingestion. And finally, before we go to our phones, and you can call us now at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. This is from Joanne Harry of The Nation magazine. It's entitled The UK's, United Kingdom's Left-Wing Tea Party. I'm only going to read just the first page. Quote, imagine a parallel universe where the great crash of 2008 was followed by a tea party of a very different kind. Enraged citizens gather in every city week after week to demand the government finally regulate the behavior of corporations and the super rich and force them to start paying taxes. The protesters shut down the shops and offices of the companies that have most aggressively ripped off the country. The swelling movement is made up of everyone from teenagers to pensioners. They surround branches of the banks that caused this crash and force them to close, with banners saying, "You caused this crisis, now you pay." As people see their fellow citizens acting in self-defense, these tax-the-rich protests spread to even more conservative parts of the country. It becomes a most-discussed subject on Twitter. Even right-wing media outlets, sensing a startling effect on the public mood begin to praise the uprising and dig up damning facts on the tax dodgers. Instead of the fake populism of the Tea Party, there is a movement based on real populism. It shows there is an alternative to making the poor and middle class pay for a crisis caused by the rich. It shifts the national conversation. Instead of letting the government cut our services and increase our taxes, the people demand that it cut the endless and lavish aid for the rich and make them pay the massive sums they dodge in taxes. This may sound like a fantasy, but it has all happened. The name of this parallel universe is Britain. As recently as this past fall, people were asking the same questions liberal Americans have been gloomily contemplating. Why is everyone being so passive? Why are we letting ourselves be ripped off? Why are people staying in their homes watching their flat screens while our politicians strip away services so they can fatten the super rich even more? And then 12 ordinary citizens, a nurse, a firefighter, a student, a TV researcher, and others, met in a pub in London one night and realized they were asking the wrong questions. Quote, "We had spent all this energy asking what wasn't happening," says Tom Phipps, a 23-year-old nurse who was there that night. "And then we suddenly said, that's what everyone else is saying too. Why don't we just do it? Why don't we just start? If we do, maybe everyone will stop asking why it isn't happening and join in." It's a bit like Kevin Costner's film, Field of Dreams. We thought, if you build it, they will come. Now, that's all I'm going to read of a long article. But here's the long and short of it. So all over Britain, the people who were having their services cut, their pensions cut, they took over banks. They boycotted stores and businesses that were getting the benefit of a bailout. And we have seen no such efforts of any kind here in the United States. And unfortunately, the only time we've seen people was in Wisconsin when they went to the streets, and rightly so, to protest their benefits being challenged to school teachers. But why didn't I see these school teachers protesting when people's homes were being foreclosed and marshals were throwing them out on the street without any care of what could happen? Why weren't they protesting when politicians were having elections served to them on a gold platter based upon a Supreme Court ruling, Citizens United, as long as they did the bidding of the Koch brothers and other rich fat cats from the left-to-right ideology? Why didn't they protest 11.9 million hungry children each day in the United States not getting enough nutrition? Why didn't they go to the streets and protest the denial of global warming as an important issue for America today, where it's not even on the agenda? It's rather selfish to only protest when your salary is threatened or your livelihood is threatened, instead of looking at a larger issue. And we just don't seem to care about everyone else in this country except when it impacts us and only us. But in Britain, they're doing it together. Now, here's two thoughts I have, and then I'm taking your calls. Point A, I believe that we should completely abolish the IRS and have one flat tax that every American must pay and every corporation can pay with no deductions. If we just had every corporation pay a small tax, 10%, we would gain an additional $1.3 trillion in revenue each year. Right now, the wealthiest corporations pay little or no taxes at all. So if we all paid a flat tax, we wouldn't have corporate America figuring out ways not to pay its fair share. That's just one suggestion. I have many more. Back in a moment with your calls, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Your time, your turn to speak out. I'd like to welcome you. I'm Gary Nall. Going into the last 12 minutes of our program, I'd like to hear from you. Let's say hello to, is it Raw from Washington, D.C.?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I just want to say thank you for another wonderful program. Very enlightening as usual. My question is kind of minor. It's about vitamin D3. And I've read that vitamin D3 acts like testosterone in the body. And I was wondering if that's true and whether or not it increases testosterone levels in the body or has any effect on hormones.
Yes, it does impact hormones, and virtually all the studies that I have, which are many, on vitamin D3, shows that the average American is deficient. And when you're deficient in D3, you have the following: higher incidence of heart disease, higher incidence of cancer, more inflammation in the brain, more inflammation in the arteries. You have more attack of the epithelial, the lining of the arteries. Therefore, why do you think that we don't have the flu in the summer as we do in the winter? This is not a hibernating virus. There is no such thing in science. This doesn't go away because the weather hits a certain degrees and come back out when it hits another degrees. We have the virus with us all the time. If I were to stop 100 people on the street today and take a throat swab, I would find probably 90% have either staph or strep on their body, in their body, on their throat. However, that does not mean they're going to get sick. It means you have to weigh that against your immune system and other cofactors. So we have vitamin D that we produce in the skin, about 20,000 units, what would be equivalent to 20,000 units, from about a half hour of direct sunlight in the summertime. We also don't have the same level of depression in the summertime because we're getting that sunlight. That is the big factor. Why do you think we don't have multiple sclerosis nearly at the same level in southern tropical areas as we do at northern non-tropical areas? Because of vitamin D. So vitamin D3 is very important. It's not a hormone in and of itself, but it does stimulate other hormones in the body. And it can impact testosterone levels, but chrysin and murarapuama and other maca also impact on testosterone, as does exercise, and that's why we should have about 3,000 units of vitamin D, but if I were coming down with a cold or flu, I'd go up to 5,000 units of vitamin D as well. Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
Let's say hello to Josephine in New York. Hi, Josephine. You're on the air.
Hi, Gary. I was wondering, I heard about grounding not long ago, and if...
Sorry. I'm not hearing you. I think Josephine...
Stand in it, and to have him...
I couldn't hear what you just said. Please start over.
Okay. I know someone who's very old, and he is unable to get outside. He's, like, sort of bedridden. And someone told me to get a bucket of sand from the ocean and have him put his feet in it, and it will be the same thing as grounding.
No, that's not true.
Not true.
No, you have to have the magnetic pulsing by it being... having your feet on the ground, walking barefoot, on grass, or at the ocean, on a beach, yes, that will do the grounding, and that's why it's so important, or sleeping on the ground. But we don't sleep on the ground.
And not anymore.
No, there are pads that are out there in the marketplace. I have not tested them, but they exist to give the same polar frequency as grounding that people have used, and I haven't seen the results. I don't know if it's just a marketing scheme or if it's just to, you know, make promises that are not supported by the science. But if a person can at all get outside and do some barefoot walking, sitting on the ground, lying on the ground, that would be terrific.
Okay. And could I ask you one more thing?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you. If someone has a blocked chi in their heart, or their solar plex, their meridian in their heart meridian, how could they get rid of that?
Well, let's first start with one basic understanding. There is only one chi. There's only one life force. You can say, well, there are 365 meridians, and there are sub-meridians off of that, and there are seven primary chakras. This is all theoretical. What we know is that when you're alive, the only thing that's missing when you're no longer alive is your life force. We know that we have not been able to measure it. We don't know where it goes. We don't know where it comes from. We know that at the moment of inception, your body has a brain that's not formed, an immune system that is immature, still living with the mother's immune system. But the moment the child is born, they already have qualities going on in their body that they were not taught and could not learn. For example, if you stand up, your heart beats faster. You sit down, it goes slower. If you run, it speeds up. But why does it speed up? In order to pump more blood to the musculature. But how does it know not to go at 300 beats per minute where your heart would burst versus 140 that supplies enough? And how does it know at within 5 minutes to come back to normal instead of staying high? How does it know about every 8 seconds to 10 seconds to allow you to blink, to create a tear duct, keep your eyelids from chafing? But it does. How does your stomach know to digest tofu differently than a roast beef or a milkshake differently than hot tea? But it does. How does it know which bacteria to colonize in a good way and how to let your body know when you've eaten something that is bad? When you eat something that's bad, you can't see it, smell it, or taste it. You think it's okay. The body detects it. How does it know? Because it's trying to give you diarrhea to flush from the body. What told the body this is a bad microbe? But it has that consciousness. How does the body know to stimulate natural killer cell activity when there are tumor cells floating around in the bloodstream? But it does. There are over 100 million cells, from 66 to 100 million cells in the body. Everyone has to have multiple actions per day, about 10,000 gene alterations per cell occur per day. If the body didn't have the mechanisms to go in there and repair the damage to the DNA, we would be dead within a matter of weeks after being born. Even when you drink and smoke, eat bad foods and are stressed, abuse your body, at no time in your life does your body ever turn against you. Not for a second. Instead, it does all it can with unconditional love to protect you. And unfortunately, we don't understand this basic principle that all this phenomena can only exist if the cell has consciousness. But from cause and effect and a basic concept of quantum physics, where did the consciousness derive from? How did we know to do all these things if the organism itself, the human, was never taught? When a gazelle is born, it can run almost at full speed within 2 days. A baby elephant can't. But a baby elephant has a mother big enough to protect it. A female gazelle cannot protect its baby. But the female gazelle can do something unusual that the elephant couldn't. It runs and wobbles. And by wobbling, all the predatory cats look at that saying, that's the animal to go for. Predatory animals always go for the weakest and the most infirm within any of the animals they're looking at because they know that they'll have least damage to themselves. After all, a cat doesn't want to get gored by an impala, because then it would die or couldn't feed itself. And then it itself would become a victim of it, what it didn't do right. A human at a year is just beginning to walk. A cow comes out as a calf, and it starts to immediately lick everything in its environment. And these are generally very dirty environments in a barn. It's picking up every kind of microbe imaginable, viruses, parasites, bacteria. The mother continues to lick the baby's face. Why? Because they're exchanging antibodies. The mother picks up all the microorganisms, the calf, or the horse, or the bull, doesn't matter which species, it's all the same, and immediately her body creates antibodies that come through in the breast milk for natural immunization. So therefore, each animal is able to survive and grow and thrive based upon its needs in the evolutionary scale. A chimpanzee evolves very, very slow, just like a human. But it's smart and strong. It's 10 times stronger than a human. A 200-pound chimpanzee could throw a 200-pound man up against a wall.
Ooh.
Having raised chimpanzees, did you ever hear the Dave Garraway show on NBC?
I've heard of it, yes.
Well, there was a chimpanzee on the show called Kokomo Jr. I was one of the people who raised Kokomo Jr.
And worked with, I knew.
And worked with Kokomo. So Kokomo could identify 167 separate words on an intellectual level and respond to them. And when Kokomo would be wanting love, she would come over, she'd get up on my lap and give me hugs and little kisses.
Oh.
Not because she wanted food, she wanted love. So once you see that, once you are go from the rigidity of your belief into a neutral state, you can see things for what they are, not what we need them to be. And that's true in all species. So now come back around. When I was doing my racing, and I've done over 627 races I've won every championship I've ever been in. I have not lost a race in over 30 years. I was Athlete of the Year, Master Male Athlete of the Year in New York from the Metropolitan Athletic Congress out of 25,000 athletes, three times, the indoor and twice outdoors. And the Florida Male Racewalker of the Year in all age divisions in 2006. And then I would have won it this past year, but I missed two races. I set eight state records this year. Now, I say that not to brag, but because there's a lesson behind this. There was a time when I was racing three times a week. I did six marathons in 8 weeks. I brought back a gold in the Los Angeles Marathon, Jamaica Marathon, the Waterfront Marathon, the Jersey Shore Marathon. I did the first Marine Corps Marathon, London Marathon, Montreal Marathon. I did a lot of the first marathons, too. And I had a running club, still do. And it was a wonderful experience. But in order to train and race at a highly competitive level, I had to get up early in the morning, 3:30, and sometimes do 3 hours of running, 18 miles. I was training frequently 100 miles a week on the road, and it was nothing at all to run at a 5-minute pace, and then doing VersaClimber and weight work and everything else. But it served its purpose. I was able to do an awful lot and taught other people racing, and we had a great club. At the same time, I was doing lectures frequently twice a day, and also I was writing and doing my broadcast, plus working in the lab at night, so I had a packed schedule. And then one day it all ended. My chi was just diminished. My biochemistry was no different. My hormone levels, no viruses, no bacteria, but there was no vital life force. The chi I had used up. And that's where I learned that there's not a chi for intellect and a chi for sex and a chi for creating and a chi for praying. And there's only one vital life force. So you have to live your life in balance with this. If you're stressed, you use up your chi. If you're non-productive, you use up your chi. If you're productive in the wrong way and imbalance yourself, as I did, you use up your chi. I also learned that the only way you can revive your chi is not through any nutrient or food, but instead getting to a quiet place, in effect, a respite from the imbalances of life. Nature is where I chose to be, and I believe that's your greatest single way of reviving this vital life force. And then your vitalized force flows freely through your body. There's not one vitalized force for your heart, the third chakra, or one for your sexual reproduction, your first chakra, or one for your crown chakra. That's all myth. You have one life force. How you choose to interpret your life, whether you choose to live an authentic life or live through the conditioning of other people, determines what part of your life you will open to or what part you will close to, what beliefs you will not challenge, what beliefs you would challenge. And that's why today we have so many sick and unhappy Americans And then look at our nation. We're not standing up for what is right. We're not protesting what we need to. Instead, we're very selfish. This shows that our chi is diminished, and from that, our life suffers. Hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Gary. You're terrific. I really appreciate it.
All the best to you, Josephine from New York. And for all of you, thank you very much for taking your time to listen today. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.
The Gary Noel Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.